I grew up an orphan, with nothing but a few vague memories of my father before he died. My childhood hadn't been the kind of thing I'd wish on anyone. I had run into some bad people. Justin was the worst, a true monster. When I was 16 or 17, still agonized by his betrayal, and certain that I would never know anything like a home, friends, or family, I made myself a promise. I would never allow a child of mine to grow up as I had, driven from home to home, an easy victim with no protector, never stable, never certain. Never. When Susan had asked me to help her recover Maggie, I went all in without a second thought. The child was my daughter. It didn't matter that I hadn't known about her, or that I had never seen her with my own eyes. There was a child of my blood who needed my help and protection. I was her father. I would die to protect her if need be. End of story. I may have had good reasons. I may have had the best of intentions. But intentions aren't enough, no matter how good they are. Intentions can lead you to a place where you are able to make a choice. It's the choice that counts. To get my daughter back, I'd crossed a line. Not just crossed it, I'd sprinted at it, and taking a flying freaking leap over it. I'd made a pact with the Queen of Air and Darkness, giving away my free will, my very self, to Mab, in exchange for power enough to challenge the Red King and his monstrous court. That was stupid. I'd had excuses at the time. My back had been against the wall. Actually, it had been broken and against a wall. All the help I'd been able to call upon, all the allies and tricks and techniques in my arsenal had not been enough. My home had been destroyed, so had my car. I couldn't even get up and walk, much less fight. And the forces arrayed against me had been great, so great that even the White Council of Wizards was terrified of confronting them. In that bleak hour, I had chosen to sell my soul. And after that, I had led my closest friends and allies out on what I knew was practically a suicide mission. I'd known that such a battle would put a savage strain on Molly's psychic senses, and that even if she did manage to survive, she might never be the same. I'd risked the two irreplaceable Swords of the Cross in my keeping, sending them into the battle, even though I knew that if we fell, some of the world's mightiest weapons for good would be captured and lost. And when I saw that the sacrificial blood rite the Red King had intended to destroy me could be turned back on the Red Court, I had used it without hesitation. I murdered Susan Rodriguez on a stone altar in Chichen Itza and wiped out the Red Court. I saved my little girl. I created a perfect situation for chaos to engulf the supernatural world. The sudden absence of the Red Court might have removed thousands of monsters from the world, but it meant only that tens of thousands of other monsters were suddenly free to rise, to expand into the vacuum I'd created. I shuddered as I wondered how many other men's little girls had been hurt and killed as a result. And, God help me, I would do it again. It wasn't right, it wasn't noble, it wasn't good. I'd spent less than 3 hours in the company of my daughter, and so help me, if it meant keeping her safe, I would do it again. Maybe the White Council needed an 8th law of magic, the law of unintended consequences. How do you measure one life against another? Can thousands of deaths be balanced by a single life? Even if Mab had not had time to fully take possession of me, how could I be sure that the very act of choosing to cross that line had not changed me into something monstrous? I found myself stopped, standing on the Michigan Avenue bridge over the Chicago River. The mounded snow filled the night with light. Only the waters below me were dark, a black and whispering shadow, the Lethe and the Styx in one. I looked up at the towers nearby, NBC, Trump's Place, the Sheraton. They stood tall and straight and clean in the night. Lights winked golden in windows. I turned and stared south of me at the loop, at the skyline I knew so well. There was a rare moment of stillness down Michigan Avenue. Street lights, traffic lights, a scattering of fresh snowflakes, enough to keep everything pretty and white instead of slushy and brown. God, my town is beautiful. Chicago. It's insane and violent and corrupt and vital and artistic and noble and cruel and wonderful. It's full of greed and hope and hate and desire and excitement and pain and happiness. The air sings with screams and laughter, with sirens, with angry shouts, with gunshots, with music. It's an impossible city, at war with itself, every horrible and wonderful thing blending together to create something terrifying and lovely and utterly unique. I had spent my adult life here, fighting, bleeding, to protect its people from threats they thought were purely imaginary. And because of what I'd done, the lines I'd crossed, the city had gone mad. Fomor in their turtlenecks, freakish ghost riots, huddled groups of terrified folks of the supernatural community. I hadn't meant for that to happen, but that didn't matter. I was the guy who made the choice. This was all on me. I stared down at the quiet blackness of the river. I could go down there, I realized. Running water would disrupt supernatural energy, disperse it, destroy the pattern in which it flowed. And I was made out of energy now. The black, whispering river could make everything go away. Styx, Lethe, oblivion. My apprentice was bitter, damaged. My friends were fighting a war, and it was tearing at their souls. The one guy who I was sure could help me out had been snatched, and there wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. Hell's bells. I was doing well just to find someone who could hear me talk. What could I do? What do you do to make up for failing everyone in your life? How do you make it right? How do you apologize for hideous things you never intended to happen? I don't remember when I fell to my knees. Memories, stirred by my rumination, flooded over me, almost as sharp and real as life. Those memories stirred others and brought them along like pebbles triggering a landslide. My life in Chicago rolled over me, crushed me. All the black pain and bright joy doubling me over, ripping tears out of my eyes. Later it was quiet. It was difficult. A tremendous, slow inertia resisted my desire, but I pushed myself to my feet again. I turned away from the river. This city was more than concrete and steel. It was more than hotels and businesses and bars. It was more than pubs and libraries and concerts. It was more than a car and a basement apartment. It was home. My home. Sweet home, Chicago. The people here were my family. They were in danger, and I was part of the reason why. That made things pretty clear. It didn't matter that I was dead. It didn't matter that I was literally a shadow of my former self. It didn't matter that my murderer was still running around somewhere out there, vague prophecies of Captain Murphy notwithstanding. My job hadn't changed. When demons and horrors and creatures of the night prey on this city, I'm the guy who does something about it. Time to start doing, I whispered. I closed my hands into fists, straightened my back, and vanished. Chapter 25. I was 10 minutes late to the meeting with Fitz, but he was still there, lurking at a nearby storefront, looking about as innocent as an only child near a fresh Kool-Aid stain. He had a huge, empty sports equipment bag hanging over one shoulder. For the love of God. The kid might as well have been wearing a stocking cap and a black mask with a giant dollar sign printed on the outside of his bag to boot. I appeared next to him and said, "You look so relaxed and calm. I'll bet any cop that rolls by will ask you for tips on self-control." Fitz twitched, clearly controlling an instant instinct to flee. Then he spat on the frozen ground and said, "You're late, Harvey." "Forgot to wind my watch," I said. And I was starting to think my brain had thrown a rod after all. Fitz looked up and down the street and shook his head. But nothing's ever that easy. Life can be a bitch that way, I said. So you're real.
I'm real.
Fitz nodded.
You said you would help. Were you serious about that?
Yes, I said. A gust of wind pulled his longish, curly red hair out to one side. It matched his lopsided smirk.
Fine. Help.
Okay, I said. Turn left and start walking. Fitz put a fist on his hip and said,
You were going to help me with the guns.
Never said that, I said. You need help, kid, not tools. Guns aren't going to cut it. I waited for him to begin to speak before I interrupted him.
Besides, if you don't play along, I've arranged for word to get to Murphy about where you and your band of artful dodgers are crashing.
Oh, he snarled. You son of a bitch.
Excuse me, I said.
You can go fuck yourself.
You need help, I've got it to give. But there ain't no free lunch, kid. I said in a calm and heartless tone. You know that.
You can kiss my ass is what you can do, he said, and turned away. Go ahead and walk, I said. But you're throwing away your only chance to get your crew out from under Baldy.
He stopped in the middle of taking a step.
If you bug out now, where are you going to go? Back to Baldy? He'll kill you for failing to get the guns. And after that, Murphy's crew and the rag lady will take out the whole building. Baldy will probably skate out on your buddies and do the same thing to some other batch of kids.
Fitz turned his head in my general direction, his eyes murderous. But he was listening.
Look, kid, doesn't have to be the end of the world. If you work with me, everything's peachy.
I was lying, of course. The last thing I wanted was to hand Murphy a convenient target in her present frame of mind. And I really did want to help the kid, but I've been where he was, mentally. He wouldn't have believed in a rescuer on a white horse. In his world, no one just gave anyone anything, except maybe pain. The best you could hope for was an exchange, something for something. And generally, you got screwed even then. I needed his cooperation. Handing him a familiar problem was the best way to get it.
I'm not a monster, Fitz. And honestly, I don't care about you and your goons or what happens to you. But I think you can help me. And I'm willing to help you in return if you do.
The young man grimaced and bowed his head.
It's not as though I have a lot of choice, is it?
We've all got choices, I said calmly. At the moment, yours are limited. You gonna play ball?
Fine, Fitz spat. Fine, whatever.
Groovy, I said. Hang a left and get going. We've got some ground to cover. He shoved his hands into his pockets, his eyes sullen, and started walking.
I don't even know who the hell you are.
My name is Harry Dresden, I said.
Fitz stumbled. Holy shit, he said.
Like that Harry Dresden? The professional wizard?
The one and only.
He recovered his pace and shook his head.
I heard you were dead.
Well, yeah, I said, but I'm taking it in stride.
They say you're a lunatic, Fitz said.
Oh, yeah, Fitz nodded.
They also...
He frowned. I could see the wheels spinning.
They also say you help people.
So?
So which is it?
You've got half a clue, Fitz, I said. You know that talk is cheap. There's only one way to find out.
Fitz tilted his head to one side and then nodded.
Yeah. So, where are we going?
To visit an old friend.
We went to a street toward the north end of the south side. Seedy wasn't a fair description for the place, because seeds imply eventual regrowth and renewal. Parts of Chicago are wondrous fair, and parts of Chicago look post-apocalyptic. This block had seen the apocalypse come, grunted, and said, meh. There were no glass windows on the block, just solid boards, mostly protected by iron bars and gaping holes. Buildings had security fences outside their entrances, literally topped with razor wire. You'd need a blowtorch to get through them. At least one of the fences in my line of sight had been sliced open with a blowtorch. Metal cages covered the streetlights, too. But they were all out anyway. Tough to make a cheap metal cage that stops rounds from a handgun. Every flat, open space had been covered in spray-painted graffiti, which I guess we're supposed to call urban art now, except art is about creating beauty. These paintings were territorial markers, the visual parallel to peeing on a tree. I've seen some gorgeous outlaw art, but that wasn't in play here. The thump thud of a ridiculously overpowered woofer sent a rumbling rhythm all up and down the block, loud enough to make the freshly fallen snow quiver and pack in a little tighter. There was no one in sight, no one. Granted, it was getting late, but that's still an oddity in Chicago. I watched as Fitz took in the whole place and came to the same conclusion I had the first time I'd seen it. The obvious squalor, the heavy security, the criminally loud music with no one attempting to stop it. "This is territory," he said, coming to an abrupt halt. "I'm alone. I'm unarmed. And I'm not going there." "Vice lords," I said. "Or they were a few years ago. They're a long-term gang, so I assume they still are." "Still not going there," said Fitz. "Come on, Fitz," I said. "They aren't so bad, for a gang. They almost always have a good reason to kill the people they kill. And they keep the peace on this street, if you aren't too far behind on your payments." "Yeah, they sound swell." I shrugged, though he couldn't see it. "Police response time for this place is way the hell after everything has already happened. People here are more likely to get help from a gang member than a cop if they're in trouble." "You're a fan?" "No," I said. "It shouldn't be like this. The gangs are dangerous criminals. They rule through force and fear, but at least they don't pretend to be anything else." Fitz grimaced and looked down to stare at his open palms for a moment. Then he said, "Guess I'm not in a place where I can throw stones." "You couldn't break anything if you did," I said. "You're of no use to me dead, kid. We're not going down the block. First place on the right. If you don't walk past there, you won't be crossing any lines." Fitz frowned.
"The place with the metal shutters?"
"Yeah. You remember what I told you to say?"
"Yeah, yeah, I remember the script," Fitz said, scowling. "Can we get this over with?"
"I'm not the one who can knock on the door." He scowled more deeply and started walking. The building he went to was part of a larger building that had once held four small businesses. One had been a clinic, one a lawyer, and one a small grocery. They were gutted and empty now. Only the fourth one remained. The metal shutter over the doorway held the only thing that looked like actual art, a nearly life-sized portrait of a rather dumpy angel. The hem of his robe, dirty and frayed, his messy hair doing nothing to conceal his oncoming baldness. He held a donut in one hand and had a sawed-off shotgun pointing straight toward the viewer in the other.
"Heh," I said, "that's new."
Fitz regarded the painting warily.
"What is this place again?"
"A detective agency," I said. "Ragged Angel Investigations."
"Looks kind of closed," Fitz said.
"Nick can't afford an apartment," I said. "He sleeps here. He drinks sometimes. You might have to be loud." Fitz eyed the block and then the door.
"Yeah, great."
He rapped on the metal shutter. Nothing happened. He repeated it, knocking slightly louder and longer. Still nothing.
"Tick-tock, kid."
He glowered in my direction. Then he started pounding on the shutter in a heavy, steady rhythm. Maybe 5 minutes later, there was a click of a speaker, evidently small enough to be concealed virtually in plain sight.
"What?"
said a cranky, whiskey-roughened voice.
Fitz said. "Are you Nick Christian?"
"Who wants to know?"
"My name is Fitz," the kid said. He'd pitched his voice slightly higher than usual. It made him sound a hell of a lot younger. "Harry Dresden said that if I was ever in trouble, I could come to you."
There was a long silence. Then Nick's voice said heavily,
"Dresden is history."
"That's why I'm here," Fitz said. "I don't have anywhere else to go."
Nick sounded annoyed.
"Damn it. He told you to say that, didn't he?"
Fitz looked slightly bemused.
"Well, yes, actually."
"I'm getting too old for this crap," he growled.
Then there were several loud clicks and a short, heavy screech of metal, and the shutter rolled up. Nick Christian hadn't changed much since I'd last seen him. He was short, out of shape, well past his 50th birthday, and had sharp, quick, dark eyes that seemed to notice everything. His bald spot was larger, so was his stomach. He was dressed in a white undershirt and boxer shorts, and he held an old wooden baseball bat in his right hand. He shivered and glared at Fitz.
"Well, boy, get in out of the cold and keep your hands in sight, or I'll brain you."
Fitz held his hands up in plain sight and went in. I followed. There was a threshold at the doorway, but it was flimsy as hell and felt more like a sheet of saran wrap than a wall. The muddling of business and home life in the same space was probably responsible. I pushed through it, following Fitz.
"Right," Nick said. "Close the shutter and the door. Turn all the locks."
Fitz eyed Nick for a moment. Streetwise and cynical, the kid didn't like the idea of locking himself into a strange building with a strange old man.
"It's all right, Fitz," I said. "He might kick your ass out his door if you give him trouble, but he won't do anything to hurt you."
Fitz glowered in my general direction again, but he turned and followed Nick's instructions. We stood in his one-room office. It looked almost exactly like mine had, though I'd never compared the two in my head before. Old filing cabinets, a coffee machine, a desk, and a couple of chairs that had been pushed all the way to one wall to make room for a simple folding cot on an aluminum frame. Nick also had a computer and a television set, features my office never had. Nick was no wizard. Just an old detective with a set of iron principles and a self-appointed mandate to help people find their lost children. There were also 7 pictures on his wall, every one of them an 8x10 school photo of a child between the ages of 6 and 13. The first few were faded, the hair and clothing styles in them clearly aged. Nick went around to the back of his desk, sat down, pulled a bottle of rye from the top drawer, and slugged back a swallow. He capped it, put it back, and eyed Fitz warily.
"I don't get involved in Dresden's line of work," he said. "I know my limits."
"The magic stuff," Fitz said. Nick shuddered and glanced at his top drawer.
"Yeah, that. So, if you came here for that, you're out of luck."
"No," Fitz said. "It's about gangs. Dresden said you knew them." Nick shrugged one shoulder.
"Some."
"A man I know was abducted," Fitz said. "There's a description of the guy we think did it." Fitz dished out what I remembered about the thug who had broken into Morty's house. Nick listened to it all without saying a word. Then he nodded once. Then he asked,
"Who is this man to you?"
"No idea," Fitz said. "You're the expert."
"Not the kidnapper," Nick sighed. "The victim."
Fitz hardly hesitated. "My uncle." Nick mused over that. Then he said,
"I am too old to get up in the middle of the night and get conned. Get out."
"Wait," Fitz said, holding out a hand. "Wait, please." Nick opened the top drawer again, but this time he came out with an old 1911. He didn't point it at Fitz.
"Good try, kid. But I've been in this town a while. Walk back to the door and let yourself out."
"Damn it," I muttered.
"Fitz, listen to me. Tell him this, word for word."
Fitz listened, nodded, and then said, "I can't tell you everything for a reason, Mr. Christian. Dresden said you and he had an understanding, that you wanted nothing to do with his side of the street."
"I don't," he said. "Get out."
I fed Fitz his next line. "He also said that you owed him a favor." Nick narrowed his eyes to slits.
"What favor?"
Fitz listened to me, then said, "All the money and fame the Astor case brought you." Nick arched an eyebrow.
"All the—"
He looked away and shook his head. He couldn't keep the smile off his mouth until he finally snorted. When he spoke, there was laughter under his words.
"That sounds like Harry."
The Astor case had been about a little girl lost. Her parents cared more about the fame of having an abducted daughter than they did about her. And when she ran off one day, they hired the child recovery specialist Nick Christian and his apprentice, Harry Dresden, to find her. We did. She hadn't been kidnapped, but the Astors had reported her so, and in the absence of an actual perpetrator, fingered Nick and me. It had been a trick and a half to get her safely back into her parents' custody without going to jail. There was a lawsuit afterward. The judge threw it out. But all in all, finding that little girl had cost Nick about $2,000. Nick hadn't wanted to take the case. I had talked him into it. He had wanted to cut and run the moment I confirmed the kid was at liberty. I had talked him into seeing it through, being sure she was safe. When I'd completed my apprenticeship, Nick's graduation present had been to forgive me the $2,000 I owed him. "You were tight with him?" Nick asked.
"He was sort of my advisor," Fitz said. "Sometimes it's almost like he's right there next to me, still."
Nick grunted. "Investigation apprentice or the other kind?" Fitz put on a sober face.
"I'm not at liberty to say."
"Huh," Nick said, nodding. "Heard he picked up an apprentice. You're holding back to keep me distanced from the situation."
"Yes."
"And you just want the information? You don't want me to work the field on it?"
"That's right."
Nick said. He scratched at his ear and said, "Yeah, I guess. What else can you tell me about this guy?"
I fed Fitz his lines. "He was crazy."
Nick snorted. "Whole hell of a lot of gangers are crazy, kid. Or the next best thing."
"Less money, drugs, sex, violence crazy," Fitz said. "More creepy cult crazy."
"Huh," Nick said. Lines appeared on his brow.
"There's one where they all wear the hoodies with the hoods up all the time. Got rolling maybe 3 or 4 years back. They don't call themselves anything, but the gangs call them the Big Hoods. No one knows much about them."
"Perfect," I said to Fitz. "Sounds like the assholes we're looking for. Ask them where they're set up."
"A tunnel under the Eisenhower Expressway, on the south end of the meatpacking district. The other gangs think they're crazy to be where the cops move so freely, but the Big Hoods never seem to attract any police attention."
He scrunched up his eyes.
"Don't think they even claim any territory. That's all I got."
"Because they aren't a gang, per se," I said.
"Excellent, Fitz. Let's move."
"Thank you," Fitz said to Nick.
"Thank Dresden. Wouldn't have said that much to anyone else."
"I'll do that." Fitz stared intently at Nick for a moment and then said, "What do you do here?"
"As a private cop?" Nick asked. "Take some cruddy work to keep the lights on, divorces and so on. But mostly I look for lost kids."
"Doing it a while?" Fitz asked.
30 years.
"Find any?"
"Plenty."
"Find any in one piece?"
Nick stared hard at Fitz for a long time. Then he pointed a finger up and behind him to the row of portraits on the wall.
7?
Fitz asked.
7, Nick said.
"In 30 years? You live like this in 7? That's it? That's all?"
Nick leaned back in his chair and gave Fitz a small smile.
"That's enough."
Outside, Fitz said to me, "He's crazy."
"Yeah,"
I said,
"and he helps people."
Fitz frowned and moved hurriedly back out of the Vice Lord's domain. He was silent for several blocks, seemingly content to walk beside me and think. Eventually, he looked up and asked,
"You still there?"
"Yeah."
"All right, I helped you. Pay up."
"Okay," I said. "Take a right at the next corner."
"Why?"
"So I can introduce you to someone who will help." Fitz made a rude sound.
"You really love not telling people things, don't you?"
"I don't love it so much as I'm just really good at it." Fitz snorted.
"Does this guy drink too?"
"Nah, sober as a priest."
"Fine," Fitz sighed, and kept trudging.
Chapter 26.
"You've got to be kidding me," said Fitz.
We were standing outside St. Mary of the Angels. Calling the place a church is like calling Lake Michigan a swimming hole. It's huge, literally taking up an entire city block and an architectural landmark of Chicago. Gorgeously built, a true piece of Gothic art, both inside and out, St. Mary's had often served as a refuge for people with the kind of trouble Fitz was facing. The kid was not in good shape. We'd done a considerable bit of hiking that evening, and despite what might have been the beginnings of a thaw, it was still below freezing, and the slight lack of bitter cold in the wind wasn't stopping it from cutting through Fitz's layers of mismatched clothing and his old jacket. Those lean, gangly kids have the worst of it when winter sets in. They lose their body heat fast. He'd been making up for it in exercise, but he was getting tired. And I remembered that he probably hadn't eaten since I'd seen him before the previous day's sunrise. He stood clutching his arms around his body, shivering and trying to look like nothing was wrong. His teeth were chattering. "I know a guy here," I said. "Go around to the back door and knock until someone answers. Ask for Father Forthill." Fitz looked skeptical. "What's he gonna do for me?" "Give you a blanket and some hot food for starters," I said. "Look, kid, I'm giving you my A game here. Forthill's a decent guy. This is what he does." Fitz clenched his jaws.
"This isn't getting me the guns back. I can't go back without them. If I can't go back, I can't get my crew out."
"Go inside," I told him. "Talk to Forthill. Get some food in you. If you decide you want to go back and try to sneak the guns out of that drift on your own, you'll have plenty of time before dawn." Fitz set his jaw stubbornly. "Your choice, man," I said. "But going hungry and cold like this is hard on the body. You had, what, 7 weapons? Most of them submachine guns? Comes out to maybe 40 pounds. Call it 50 if you bring back all the clips and ammo. Think you can burrow into a half-frozen snowbank, get all those guns out, load them up, and walk for most of an hour in the coldest part of the night? On an empty stomach? Without a cop spotting you and wondering what a guy your age is doing on the dark street so late, carrying a really heavy bag?" He grunted. "At least have a damn sandwich." Fitz's stomach gurgled audibly, and he sighed. "Yeah, okay." It took Fitz 5 minutes to get anyone to answer the door, and when it finally opened, a dour, sour-looking elderly man in a heavy brown bathrobe, vaguely reminiscent of a monk's habit, opened the door. His name was Father Paolo, and he took himself very seriously. Fitz told him that he needed to see Father Forthill, that it was a matter of life and death. Only after several minutes of emphasizing his original statement did Father Paolo sigh and invite Fitz in.
"Stay there,"
Paolo said, pointing a stern finger at Fitz. Fitz pointed at the ground questioningly and then nodded.
"Got it."
Then he deliberately took a small shuffle step to one side as the priest began to turn away, drawing a scowl worthy of at least a cardinal. I probably shouldn't have undermined Paolo's authority by chuckling like that, but come on, that's comedy. Forthill came down the hall from his chambers a few moments later, dressed in flannel pajamas and a heavy black terry cloth robe. He had thick, fuzzy house shoes on his feet, and his fringe of hair was standing up every which way. His bright blue eyes were a little watery and squinty without the aid of his glasses. He blinked at Fitz for a moment and then said,
"Can I help you, my son?"
"Harry Dresden said you could," Fitz said. Forthill raised his eyebrows.
"Ah, perhaps you should come with me."
Fitz looked around and then nodded.
"I guess."
Forthill beckoned and led Fitz back down some hallways to the neat, modest chamber where he slept and lived. It was maybe 10 feet square and contained a bed, a desk, a chair, and a couple of lamps. Forthill let Fitz in, then closed the door behind the young man.
"Please have a seat, my son."
Fitz looked around for a moment, then sat down on the chair. Forthill nodded and sat on the edge of the bed.
"First things first," he said, his eyes twinkling.
"Should I give you a good setup line for you to make a pithy comment about Catholic priests and sexual abuse of young men? Or would you prefer to find your own opening during the conversation?" Fitz blinked a couple of times and said,
"What?"
"Such remarks are apparently quite popular. I wouldn't want to deny you the enjoyment."
No, that's all right, Father."
Forthill nodded gravely.
"As you wish. Shall we talk about your problems now?
All right.
Well, then, the priest said, perhaps you should start by telling me when Dresden told you to come to me for help.
Fitz said. He glanced around as if looking for me.
Go ahead, I told him. Just tell him the truth. It's all right.
Fitz took a deep breath and said,
About 30 minutes ago, Father. Fort Hill's eyebrows tried to turn themselves into a toupee.
Oh?
Yeah, Fitz said, his eyes restless. I hear dead people.
That must be disconcerting.
I'm not crazy, Fitz said quickly. I never thought you were, my son, Fort Hill said.
Fitz gave him a suspicious scowl.
You believe me?
The old man gave him an imp's grin. I'm well aware of the supernatural facets of our city, and that the streets have been particularly dangerous for the past 6 months or so.
That's putting it sort of lightly, Father, Fitz said.
He nodded.
I'm sure your experience has not been a gentle one, he said. I won't add to it with my own disbelief.
Fitz bit his lower lip for a moment.
Okay. I am also aware, Fort Hill continued, that Dresden's shade is apparently taking a hand in things.
I assume that's who you've spoken to?
Yeah.
Fort Hill nodded and looked around the room.
He's here with you, isn't he?
Wow, I said. Points for Fort Hill.
Yeah, Fitz sighed. He kind of doesn't shut up.
Fort Hill chuckled.
He was a very determined young man.
Hasn't changed, Fitz said.
I see, the priest said.
My son, I am sure you understand that these are perilous times. I'm afraid that I must ask for some kind of confirmation that this entity is who he says he is.
Fitz looked at the priest blankly, then around the room.
You hear that?
Yeah, I said. I walked over to the far wall of the room and stuck my head through it. On the other side was a dark space, a hidden storage compartment just large enough to contain a couple of small file cabinets. The concealed compartment had been unknown to anyone but Fort Hill until I worked a case for an archangel a while back. Michael Carpenter and I had seen him open the hidden cabinet.
Come over here, I said. Knock on the wall, right here. Fort Hill will know what it means.
Dude, Fitz said, I can't see where you are.
I sighed. Can you hear my voice?
Yeah, he said, but it's just like this disembodied thing. There's not much direction to it.
Which made sense. He was not actually physically hearing me speak. Fitz's gift to sense spirits simply expressed itself as something his mind could interpret, in this case auditory stimulus.
Okay, I said. Walk over to the back wall of the room, the one you were facing when you came through the door.
Fitz said to Fort Hill, he's trying to tell me how to prove he isn't full of crap.
Then he stood up and walked across the room.
Okay, I said. Put your hand out on the wall. Now move to your right. Little more. Little more. Too far. Okay. Now about 9 inches down and rap on it with your knuckles.
Fitz did all of that and finally knocked on the wall. Then he turned to Fort Hill and said,
mean anything to you?
The old priest pursed his lips and nodded.
Indeed. Indeed it does.
Man, Fitz said, shaking his head. Old people.
Fort Hill smiled at that.
Well, my son,
are you as cold and hungry as you look?
Fitz tried to look nonchalant.
I could eat, I guess.
How long has it been since you've had a hot shower?
Fitz rolled his eyes and said, now, if that isn't a straight line, I don't know what is.
Fort Hill chuckled and spoke to the air.
Dresden, I'm sure that you're in a hurry, and that there is some kind of dire deadline, but I'm not talking business with you until the young man is seen to.
He said to Fitz, that door leads to my bathroom. There's a shower. There's a cardboard box under the sink with several items of clothing in it. I keep them on hand for events such as this. Feel free to take any of them.
Fitz just stared, frowning.
Okay. Get cleaned up,
Forthill replied, his tone firm. I'll go round up something to eat while you do.
Do you prefer tea or cocoa?
Fitz said, I guess cocoa.
Excellent taste, Forthill said, if you'll excuse me.
He left the room quietly. Fitz started looking around the room immediately. I doubt there's much to steal, I said. Forthill isn't really into material things.
You kidding? Look at this place. Pillows? Blankets?
He looked under the bed.
3 pairs of shoes? It's a hell of a lot more than my crew has. 0 rolls and 4 pairs of socks and some old moccasin house slippers. Guy's offering you clothes and food, I said. You're not seriously going to steal his stuff, are you?
Fitz shrugged.
You do what you have to do to live, man. I do. Everyone does. Nothing personal.
He looked in Forthill's closet at maybe 6 outfits worth of clothing and shook his head.
He'll notice if I try to take any of this stuff.
He looked toward the bathroom.
Go ahead, I said.
You can lock the door behind you. I'm telling you, kid, Forthill is one of the good guys.
That's make-believe. There ain't no good guys, Fitz said. Or bad guys. It's just guys.
You're wrong about that, I said.
Heard that one before. People who want to use you always say they're the good guys, Fitz said. You're one of them, right?
I said, no, I'm an arrogant ass. But I know what a good guy looks like, and Forthill is one of them.
Whatever, man, Fitz said. I haven't had a shower in 2 weeks.
If I tell you to buzz off, will you do it? Or do I have to keep hearing you yammer?
Sorry, Fitz, you aren't my type. He snorted, went into the bathroom, and locked the door behind him. I heard the water start up a moment later. I stood in the priest's empty chamber for a moment, looking around it. Everything there was plain, modest, functional, and cheap. The quilt covering the bed looked like it might have been made for Forthill by his mother when he went to seminary. There was a King James Bible next to the bed. It, too, looked worn and old. I shook my head. Granted, my life hadn't exactly been featured on an MTV series covering the excesses of the rich and famous, but even I'd had more than Forthill did. How could a man go through life with so little? Nothing of permanence, nothing built up to leave behind him, nothing to testify to his existence at all. The kind of man who isn't focused on his own existence, I guess. The kind of man who cares more about others than he does himself. To the point of spending the whole of his life, a life as fleeting and precious as anyone else's, in service to his faith and to humanity. There was no glamour in it, no fame. Forthill and men like him lived within their communities, where they could never escape reminders of exactly what they had missed out on. Yet he never called attention to himself over it, never sought sympathy or pity. How hard must it be for him to visit the expansive, loving Carpenter family, knowing the whole time that he could have had a family of his own? Did he ever spend time dreaming of what his wife would have been like, his children? He would never know. I guess that's why they call it sacrifice. I found Forthill in the church's kitchen, assembling a meal from leftovers. When I'd been the one taking shelter in the church, it had been sandwiches. Fitz was rating a larger meal. Hot soup, a couple of sandwiches, turkey and tuna, respectively, a baked potato, an ear of corn on the cob, and a small salad. A few seconds after I walked into the kitchen, Forthill paused, aimed a vague smile at the room, and said, "Hello, Harry. Assuming that's you, of course."
"It's me, Father," I replied.
I mean, he couldn't hear me, and I knew it, but it just seemed sort of rude not to say anything.
"I had a difficult conversation with Karen this evening," Forthill said. "She told me that you had found the persons who shot at her home last night, and that you want us to help them."
"I know," I sighed. "It sounds insane, but..."
"I think that to Karen you must have sounded quite insane," he continued. "But I consider your reaction to be remarkable for its compassion. I can only presume that the boy is one of these gang members."
He finished off the food preparations and turned to face me, more or less. "Don't worry. I have no intention of bringing Ms. Murphy into this situation, at least not for the time being. Her judgment has been
clouded since your death, and grows more so as the fighting goes on. I felt myself relax a little. I hoped you wouldn't. I will grant the boy sanctuary here for now. I'll talk with him. I'm sure he will tell me the particulars of his situation. After that, I will have to act in accordance with my conscience. Can't ask a man for more than that, Father, I said. Thank you. He picked up the simple wooden tray laden with Fitz's meal and stood there for a moment. It's a shame we can't converse. I would love to hear about your experience. I should think it would be fascinating. A chronicle of one of the most enigmatic functions of creation, death itself.
Nah, I said. The mystery doesn't stop even after you get to the other side. It's just a lot more paperwork.
Also, I find it interesting that you are here on holy ground, Fort Hill said. If I remember correctly, the last ghost who attempted to enter this church couldn't even touch the building, much less wander freely around it. What does it mean? He shook his head, bemused.
I suppose you'd be the one to ask, eh?
He tipped his head in a polite, if badly aimed, nod and left the room. It was an excellent question, the thing about ghosts and holy ground. When Leonid Kravos, a.k.a. the Nightmare, had come to kill one of my clients I'd stashed at the church, he hadn't been able to get in. He'd torn up several $1,000 worth of landscaping and flower beds in sheer frustration. The Nightmare had been a more powerful shade than I was at the moment. So why could I make myself at home, when he'd been stopped as cold as the big bad wolf at the third little pig's house? Note to self, I said. Look into apparent mystic anomaly later. Help your friends now. I sometimes give myself excellent advice. Occasionally, I even listen to it. It was time to pay a visit to the Gray Ghost and the Big Hoods. Chapter 27 I headed for the Big Hood's hideout with several important facts in mind. Fact 1, the Big Hoods themselves could not do me harm. Fact 2, there wasn't diddly I could do to the Big Hoods. Fact 3, the Big Hoods were apparently led by this Gray Ghost, a spirit that had been tossing lightning around with impunity during the attack on Morty's house. That meant that the Gray Ghost was the shade of someone with at least a sorcerer's level of talent, and while I felt sure I could defend myself against such an assault if I was ready for it, if I got blindsided, I might end up like Sir Stuart quicker than you could say Kazat. Fact 4, the Gray Ghost had a bunch of lemurs hanging around. While my own spectral evocations might not be able to affect the living, they would sure as hell work on lemurs and the like. I could handle them easily, one-on-one, but it seemed likely that they would come at me in waves, or maybe try to wear me down by throwing a horde of wraiths at me first. Fact 5, if the Gray Ghost was giving the orders to mortal cultists, they might have taken measures of their own to deal with ghosts. There might be circle traps prepared. There might be wards or other magical barriers. There might be dangerous substances like ghost dust. If I went in all fat and happy and confident, I could wander right into serious trouble. Fact 6, there were all kinds of spiritual beings in the wide universe, and ghosts were only a tiny cross-section of them. I had to be ready for anything. Another entity of some sort might well wander in, drawn by the conflict. Or hell, for all I knew, one might already be taking a hand. No closed minds, Dresden, I ordered myself. Don't get suckered into thinking this is one limited, small-scale problem. There's every chance it might be part of a much, much larger problem. If my afterlife went anything like my life had, that seemed a safe bet. Fact 7. Sooner or later, damn it, I was going to start laying out a little chastisement where it was long overdue. I flashed back to several vivid memories of when I had done exactly that. Images of violence and flame and hideous foes flickered through my head, sharp and nearly real. The emotions that accompanied those memories came along for the ride, but they were one step removed,
distant enough to let me process them, identify them. Rage, of course. Rage at the creatures who were trying to harm the innocent, or my friends, or me. That rage had been both a weapon and armor to me in moments of mortal peril. It was always there, and I always welcomed its arrival. Being filled with anger was infinitely preferable to being filled with terror. But seeing it in my heightened memories, it made me feel a little sick. Rage was a word we used for anger when it was being used in the cause of right, but that didn't sanctify it or make it somehow laudable. It was still anger. Violent, dangerous anger, as deadly as a flying bullet. It just happened to be a bullet that was aimed in a convenient direction. Fear, next. Always fear. It doesn't matter how personally courageous you are. When something is trying to kill you and you know it, you're afraid. It's a mindless, lizard-brain emotion. There's no way to stop it. Courage is about learning how to function despite the fear, to put aside your instincts to run or give in completely to the anger born from fear. Courage is about using your brain and your heart when every cell of your body is screaming at you to fight or flee, and then following through on what you believe is the right thing to do. The White Council blamed me for causing trouble with various supernatural evils, and while I'm not quite arrogant enough to blame all the world's problems on my mistakes, they probably had a point. I have issues with bullies and authority figures, and I refuse to stand by and do nothing when those too weak to defend themselves become victims. But how much of that had been courage, and how much of it had been me embracing my probably righteous anger so that I wouldn't feel the fear? As the memories flipped by, I saw myself again and again throwing myself into the fire, sometimes literally, to help someone who needed it or to kill something that needed killing. The tidal surges of my emotion had propelled me, fueled my magic, and many times they had made it possible to survive when I wouldn't have otherwise. But when I'd been running on adrenaline, I'd rarely stopped to consider the extended consequences of my actions. By saving Susan from Bianca of the Red Court, I had offered a high-profile insult to the entire vampire nation. When Duke Ortega had shown up to challenge me to a duel, to restore the honor of the Red Court and forestall a war, it had ended in a bloodbath, and it had never occurred to me to attempt to ensure any other outcome. As a result of the disastrous duel, a wizard named Ebenezer McCoy, my grandfather, had brought an old Soviet satellite down from its orbit right on top of Ortega's stronghold. No one survived. Then Ariana, Ortega's wife, the daughter of the Red King, had sought her own vengeance even as the Red Court launched a full-scale war. Ariana's vengeance had materialized in the form of murdering my daughter's foster family and abducting her. Once Susan heard about it, she got in touch, and again I flung myself into fire without a thought. None of those things had to happen. I mean, I wasn't the only guy in the world who had driven that course of events, I knew that. But I had been the guy who had been standing at the tipping point between possible outcomes with depressing regularity. Could I have done something differently? Was it even possible to know? In my memories, I murdered Susan Rodriguez again. Time heals all wounds, they say, but I somehow knew I wouldn't be able to escape this one. Granted, only a few days' subjective time had passed since the events of that evening, so the memory was still fresh in my painfully clear recollection. But time wasn't going to help much with what I'd done, and it probably shouldn't. I wanted to hurt the Gray Ghost and its merry band of shades. I wanted to hurt them badly, make them feel the vitriol burning inside my belly. I wanted to take them on and smash them to flinders upon my will. But maybe I should pause for a moment. Maybe I should think. Maybe I should reject both anger and fear and strive for an outcome beyond kicking down the door and smashing everything in my way. Play it smart. play it responsible. A little late for you to be learning that lesson now, isn't it, dummy? I asked. No. It was never too late to learn something. The past is unalterable in any event. The future is the only thing we can change. Learning the lessons of the past is the only way to shape the present and the future. Why did I want this fight so badly? Here's a thought, genius, I said to me. Maybe it's got something to do with Maggie. Maggie, my little girl. I would never see her grow up. I would never get to watch for any signs of manifesting talent so that I could teach her and give her the choice of how to live her life. I would never get to hear her sing a song or go trick-or-treating or send her a present for Christmas. I would never... At some point during that dark thunderstorm of regret, fire had erupted from seemingly every surface of my body, a furious red-gold flame. It wasn't hot at first, but after a few seconds it got uncomfortable and rapidly progressed to actual pain. I ground my teeth, closed my eyes, and forced order upon my thoughts, tried to replace the outrage with cool, steady logic. Several seconds later, the fire died away. I opened my eyes slowly, eyeing the scorch marks on my coat and a blister or two on my exposed skin. Clear bubbles of ectoplasm dribbled from the blisters. "So, yeah," I said. "You may have anger issues where Maggie is concerned, Harry." "You think?" "Got a rocket," I sang, "in your pocket. Turn off the juice, boy." Show tunes? Really? It wasn't bad enough that you started talking to yourself, man. Now you're doing performing art. But the musically inclined me had a point. "Play it cool, boy," I whispered. "Real cool." I approached the Big Hood's lair obliquely and cautiously. One might even accuse me of being overly cautious. I circled the lair from all angles, including up above, in a slow spiral-shaped pattern that only gradually drew closer. I held a veil over myself the entire time, too. It wasn't any easier as a ghost than it had been in the flesh, and I still couldn't throw the greatest veil in the world, but I managed to make myself, if not invisible, at least difficult to see. I wasn't there to fight. I was there to learn. Mort needed my help. But maybe the best way to give it to him wasn't to go charging in like a rogue rhinoceros. Knowledge is power. I needed all the power I could get if I was going to help Morty. The problem was that the gray ghost had apparently marshaled supporters of both the spirit and the flesh, and I couldn't fight the damned crazy thugs who just happened to be made of solid matter. I'd need help. Maybe I could hop into Morty again and toss out enough power to let him run away. But that assumed Morty would let me step in at all. He sure as hell didn't seem to like it the first time. It also assumed that he would be free and able to physically escape, and that I could neutralize his material captors. There was no guarantee either of those things would be the case. I thought that the tip from Nick was a good one. I think he had identified the right bunch of yahoos, and I had faith in his knowledge of Chicago streets. After a lifetime walking them and surviving, Nick was an expert. Chicago PD's gang unit sometimes went to him for advice. Sometimes he even gave it to them. But any expert could be wrong. If the Gray Ghost was wily enough to have a hideout separate from its material mook's living quarters and had stashed more there, I was about to waste a whole lot of time. But how would it get a setup of its own without physical help to establish it? If it was strong enough, I suppose, it could have a domain of its own in the never-never, the spirit world. I dealt with a ghost named Agatha Hagglethorn once, and she'd had her own little pocket dimension filled with a Victorian-era copy of Chicago. It burned down. I was not responsible. Anyway, I had to wonder if the Gray Ghost didn't have a similar resource. It would make one fine hidey hole to avoid annoying things like sunrise, daylight, and recently deceased wizards. I paused for a moment to consider a notion.
I wondered if I could establish a demeanor of my own. I mean, theoretically, I knew how it would work. Granted, there's as much space between theory and practice in magic as there is in physics, but it isn't an unbridgeable gap. I was reasonably sure